This is Central Time. College students voted more in the 2016 election compared with 2012, according to the latest National Study of Learning, Voting, and Engagement, or NSOLV, from Tufts University.
Some interesting finds in the study include that women voted more, but the gender gap didn't necessarily widen, and social science majors were more likely to vote than other majors.
And the study also found that a few states, including Wisconsin, saw a downturn in voting by college students.
Nancy Thomas joins us now. She's the director of the Institute for Democracy and Higher Education at Tufts University's Tisch College, which conducted the study. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Nancy, what were you looking for in this study?
Well, we are looking to provide colleges and universities good information about their students' habits. And we're very concerned and interested in the civic learning that goes on college campuses, and there aren't very good measures for civic learning. So we figured voting would be a good proxy for that, and by telling campuses the rates that their students vote at, they could get at least some gauge of their students' interest in matters of public affairs. So that was one big motivator for the study. The other motivator, quite frankly, is because we could do it. Probably 6 years ago, this study wouldn't have even been possible. So the change in voting records and our ability to marry them with other kinds of records really helped us make the decision to pursue this.
When you talk about your concern about civic learning on college campuses, what do you mean by that? What by civic learning?
Well, we want our students to graduate to be good citizens. We want them to be actively engaged in public life. We want them to volunteer and serve the local community. We want them to help neighbors. There are lots of ways that people can be civically engaged. And I would say about 20 years ago, some of the data was coming out that Americans were disengaging from public life. They were disengaging from each other and from their communities. And so there was a big push in higher education, what we call the civic movement, to try to get students re-engaged. A lot of that had to do with service learning, service experiences, community university partnerships. But more recently, the focus has become engagement in democracy, which includes voting.
And let's look at the big picture. What did you find when you took a look at this 2016 election and how college students participated?
Well, there's some good news and there's some not so good news. So the good news, and I think one of the most interesting data points, is that voting rates are up among college students, 3 percentage points higher than they were in 2012. And that exceeds the national average, which is, it sort of depends on which way you measure voting in public life. But we're using CPS analysis, the census analysis, and Americans voted at 2 percentage points higher than they had in 2012, and college students went up another percentage point.
If you look at the 2016 election, I think by just about any metric, it was an extraordinary election. Do you think that the results you got are a reliable indicator?
I think that they are a reliable indicator. You know, there are 20 million college students, or roughly. Sometimes there are about 18 million, but I would say, you know, somewhere in that range, 18 to 20 million. This is a one-of-a-kind study, so we base our records not on self-reports or polling, but actual records, enrollment records that we combine with voting records, so that makes it very unusual and hopefully a little more reliable. We also have a very good representative group of campuses that are in the data set. So, for example, all 50 states are represented. We have participation from all types of institutions, meaning community colleges, research universities, liberal arts colleges, state colleges, and so forth. And the database is demographically similar to the overall population of college students in America. So I would say it's a pretty good database.
And I want to ask you in particular about where I'm talking to you from, Wisconsin, because Wisconsin was one of three states that actually saw a decrease in voting, along with Mississippi and Georgia. What's the story there?
Well, the story is that Wisconsin overall, this is we just did an analysis of the 31 institutions in our study, and bear in mind that we don't have all Wisconsin campuses in our study, so I'm basing these numbers on the 31 that are in there. The story is that registration rates went significantly down, and the voting rates went down. And so if the national numbers are voting rates were up 3 percentage points, in Wisconsin they were down 3 percentage points. Now, one of the things that you have to remember is that Wisconsin was actually pretty high in 2012. So it was higher than the national average. 53% of the college students voted in Wisconsin in 2012. So that was higher than the national average. And so it did go down, and in some places, such as registration rates, it went down significantly, and for some student populations, it went down significantly. But Wisconsin is still a very engaged state.
We're talking right now with Nancy Thomas. She's the director of the Institute for Democracy and Higher Education at Tufts University's Tisch College. With us now to talk about the 2016 election and the results we saw about college students' participation, their voting in that election.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be picking up that conversation in just a few moments. Are you on a college campus yourself? Are you in that college age range, whether you're in college or not? Do you see the kind of civic participation our guest is talking about, whether it's voting or being otherwise involved in your local community? Are you involved yourself? Do you think you came out of high school knowing what you needed to know to do that? Do you think if you're in college at any level, are you learning that kind of thing? Are there opportunities to engage? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about college voting habits with Nancy Thomas, director of the Institute for Democracy and Higher Education at Tufts University's Tisch College. Tufts recently released the NSOLVE study, which looks at voting rates among college students. They found 2016 saw an increase in student voting, not here in Wisconsin, though.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a college student, what was your voting rate in 2016? 0 or 100%? Did you go to the polls? Did your peers in school go? Why do you think that is? Why do you think people didn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Nancy, before we leave the results from Wisconsin behind, you said you didn't think it was necessarily that significant that Wisconsin saw a slight decline in students who voted. But Wisconsin is a state that had, right before the election, there was a lot of back and forth in the courts about a new voter ID law. Could something like that have affected the voting rate?
Well, first of all, Veronica, I'm so sorry if I misled you. I think it's very significant that Wisconsin voting rates went down, particularly when the rest of the country went up. So I think it's certainly worth digging into. As for whether the voting laws affected the ability of college students to vote or not, I think it's certainly something to look into, but it's very hard to sort out why people do and do not vote. They need to be inspired by the candidates. They need to be able to reach the polls at a convenient time. So what we try to talk about is the difference between the technical barriers to voting and the motivations for voting. And so if you just take this data, just one little piece of it, for example, registration rates nationally went up 1%, and voting rates went up 1 percentage point, and the voting rates went up 3 percentage points. So what that tells me is that something went on that motivated students to vote more and more as the election got closer. And so obviously, if there's a barrier to voting, if students don't have the right identification, if they can't get to the polls, if they, you know, you really shouldn't discount, for example, students who don't exactly know how to vote. This is something that many of us just assume, is that the polling place is not intimidating. Well, for some people, it very well might be. So there are lots of things that we need to do to remove the technical barriers of voting. But then once those are removed, it is really important to keep people informed, to continue with political discourse on campus, and to have lots of opportunities to increase student motivation for voting.
And Nancy, as we start to wrap up, another interesting finding was there was sort of a correlation between voting and different majors. Social sciences majors, it sounds like, were very likely to vote, and STEM majors less likely.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, we saw a couple of different categories that went way up in 2016. You know, Hispanic voters went way up 7 percentage points. Asian voters went up 8 percentage points. Young voters went up 4 percentage points. So, you know, that, again, you start to think, well, what was interesting to Hispanic voters, young voters, Asian voters, and how do we dive into that? So I think you're absolutely right that these, you know, there are lots and lots of ways for people to dig into these numbers.
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Veronica. It was a pleasure.
That was Nancy Thomas, director of the Institute for Democracy and Higher Education at Tufts University's Tisch College. And she joined us today to talk about a new study looking at college students and voting.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On Friday evening at a Senate campaign rally in Alabama, President Trump took on NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem at the start of a game. The players in question say they're protesting racial injustice in the United States. The following audio contains language that some listeners might find offensive.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
The president continues his attacks via Twitter on Saturday, and responses rolled in what our guest says was an unprecedented collective action and show of solidarity by players. Liz Clark is a sports reporter for The Washington Post. Liz, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm thrilled to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we had these comments from President Trump. We heard some of them on the show today already, then followed by tweets. What were the first signs of response from NFL players and management?
Yes. You know, it's interesting because at the paper, we have been working on compiling a TikTok, so we're all clear about the point you asked. So his remarks, of course, were made in Alabama at sort of a rally, campaign-style rally, on Friday evening. So it was roughly 6 a.m. Eastern Time Saturday that the NFL formally responded with a statement from Commissioner Roger Goodell, which was critical of the comments. And that was quite notable because I think a lot of people, knowing how kind of neutral and apolitical the NFL prefers to be, as many multi-billion-dollar corporations, you know, prefer to be, a lot of people thought, well, they just might let this pass without comment. So once the commissioner made his remarks about 6 a.m. Saturday, about midday on Saturday, the New York Giants owners issued a statement that was more pointed and critical of President Trump. And so as Saturday unfolded, I believe 11 NFL teams, 11 of the 32, issued statements from their front office, either their CEO or their president. And then Sunday, the big game day, dawned, and 19 other NFL teams followed suit with statements of their own as the games unfolded, and the Washington Redskins were the last to weigh in. They played the Sunday night game, so they timed their statement around their kickoff. So at this point, if I've got it right, only two of the 32 teams have not made a formal response to the remarks. remarks.
And that's really something, because while players might venture into controversial territory, as you were saying, it seems like NFL as a league and the owners tend to be allergic to political controversy.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, you might find that many of them, I mean, they're almost all billionaires, many of them tend to be conservative, you know, on the political spectrum themselves as a matter of choice. But I think more as businessmen, you know, they don't see a lot of gain in, you know, politicizing their game. That notion that sports and politics are separate spheres has been obliterated, you know, by the events of the last 72 hours. So you no longer can separate them, as much as many fans would like to say, shut up and play. You know, if they're being harsh or just like, I want to be entertained, don't bother me with your politics, they're now intertwined, at least at this moment in the NFL. And it's not something I think the NFL was looking for, but felt the need for various reasons to respond. And that said, of the 30 teams that responded, there's a really wide range of both the tone and the substance of the statements that came out.
Right. Talk about that range a little. I'm especially interested in Robert Kraft of the New England Patriots, who had been, I believe, supportive of Donald Trump in the past, saying he was, right, disappointed in the president's remarks.
Yes. Yes. He is a Republican, a proud Trump supporter. I believe he's a significant donor, or has been, either to the campaign or to the inaugural fund, and is frequently photographed, I want to say, at Mar-a-Lago with the president. So he's you know, very proud of his political leanings, yet his statement was notable in that it mentioned, he unequivocally, he was disappointed in the president's remarks. So that kind of got a lot of people talking. Now, of all the 30 statements, very few mentioned President Trump by name. Some mentioned the presidency, but several, you know, made no mention of that, and rather spoke affirmatively of freedom of speech, players' right to voice their opinion, players' right to express themselves on issues they care about. And in some of those, if you just picked up the statement disembodied and didn't have the context, you would have no idea what the context was, you know. And the Redskins were on that spectrum, talking about football is a great unifier, and we support our servicemen and women, which are, you know, wonderful virtues that no one could take issue with. But you wouldn't naturally connect the dots. Oh, this has to do with what the president said.
We're talking to Liz Clark, sports reporter for The Washington Post, about a weekend of political protest in the NFL. And Liz, we've been spending our time in the owner's booth so far. Let's go down to the sidelines now. What
sure.
did we see from players starting in London Sunday morning and going on through the day?
Yes, it was sort of my job yesterday, while I'm among our three Redskins writers, I had the role of monitoring every game I could see, you know, to see what was unfolding on the sidelines. And the tone was set early in London with the Baltimore Ravens game, and in which players stood on the sideline for the pregame ceremonies, which typically includes the national anthem and a display of the flag, and they locked arms shoulder to shoulder to convey solidarity. And some of the players were kneeling and some stood, but among them, they presented a unified front by having a hand on the man next to him, whether seated or standing. And it was a very powerful statement, obviously a wordless statement, but a statement that we stand together. That unfolded throughout the day. There were two or three teams, I want to say the Steelers, I can't remember who else, maybe it will come to me.
I think the Seahawks.
Who chose, you know, to stay in the locker room and just sort of sit out the pregame ceremony so that the teammates were not forced to, do I stand, do I sit, do I do whatever. They just sat it out. I believe Seattle was one. And that's certainly a way to go. But for the most part, teams took the field, their customary spot along the sideline. A few teams were joined by their owners who stood along with them and linked arms. So the Redskins owner did that, as did the Eagles owner, and I believe the Jaguars owner, you know, very proudly to show that they are united. While in truth, there's a pretty big variation among players about what exactly, you know, move them to do this. What is the hot button? What's the trigger here? And what do they feel is the appropriate way to protest? You know, and there are some who feel that no matter how insulted or appalled or outraged I am, I will never kneel in the face of the American flag. I'm going to stand, but I'm also going to speak my mind. But the bigger point was, it's not going to divide our locker room. It's not going to divide our league that we have differing opinions here, but we all are one. And we, if I mean, one thing I kept hearing, and I was very moved by, is that if you call my brother an SOB, you call me an SOB. And my brother may be my teammate. He may be another NFL opponent that I want to beat silly, you know, on Sunday, but that's my brother. So there's a sense that you call one NFL player an SOB, you've called 1,800 an SOB.
And this all goes back to Colin Kaepernick, currently unemployed NFL quarterback. Mm-hmm. And he started his protests aimed at drawing attention to racial injustice, concerns about police brutality. Have players and others been specifically talking about that issue over the weekend?
Yes, certainly some, many know exactly the issue that moved Colin Kaepernick to take a knee, that it is, you know, police brutality against minorities, against African Americans. For others, the issue has gotten broader. So for others, it's, you know, kind of what I was trying to say before, I understood how Kaepernick felt, and it's certainly his right to do it. That's not going to move me to take a knee. Maybe that might have been their position up until Friday. But when the President of the United States, you know, calls for a peaceful demonstrator in their league to be fired, to lose his job, for anyone who chooses to protest in that way to lose their job, and then calls on fans to boycott the games, you know, that was like a bridge too far for many of them. It's like, whoa. Okay, so now I'm going to identify with my brother. You fire him, you fire me. Or, you know, so I know I'm kind of all over the place in explaining this, but I think there are some who are very core about the issue that started it. But I think President Trump has inflamed, kind of, you know, put a match to this and broaden the conversation and broaden the division. And you might even wonder if he's trying to drive a wedge, you know, between in locker rooms, between the fan base and the NFL, or in our country. And it, a lot of this falls along racial lines, which is why it's very significant each time, you know, white players stand alongside African American players, and as Chris Long has eloquently done, and many, many others, it's broader. They're feeling that their fundamental rights of expression are not only being attacked or denied, but, you know, the SOB thing, it clearly played well in Alabama, a state without an NFL team, a state that kind of represents the core of the president's base, if you will, but it didn't play well in locker rooms, regardless of where players stand on the spectrum of the issues.
Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That was Liz Clark, sports reporter for The Washington Post, talking about this weekend's NFL games and the reaction from players and owners to criticism from President Trump.